In this episode of the Atypical Behavior Analyst, we take you on another journey to the outer fringes of behavior analysis, this time exploring the planet of adults. But prior to arriving there, we do a little interstellar travel, revisiting the benefits of expanding into the farther reaches of the behavior analytic universe. Then, after finding our way to the planet of adults, we investigate some of the differences of working with this planet's inhabitants versus those of the more familiar kind. We then wrap up our visit by delving into some of the processes that we use to work out these differences. Welcome to the second episode of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. I'm Shanna, and I'm here with Kelly.
Yo.
And this is episode 2, Close Encounters of the Unfamiliar Kind. However, before we begin, we want to go over a few important things. First of all, we are ACE approved, which means that you can earn a CE for listening. During the talk, we'll provide you with 2 keywords that you can take to our website at atypicalba.com. You'll find the corresponding form at the bottom of each page. Once that is submitted, you'll have a CE delivered to your inbox in just a few days. Also, you can find additional resources and citations that we provide on the website. We'll try to provide the title and author's names as we reference throughout our talk, but regardless, you can always go to our website for a full list of citations. You can also find us on Facebook at Atypical Behavior Analysts. Let us know what you're doing on the outer fringes, or perhaps what you have an interest or curiosity in doing out on the fringes. We would love to hear from you. So with that said, let's go ahead and get started with episode 2, Close Encounters of the Unfamiliar Kind.
For today's talk, though, we're going to, like I said, take this small leap forward or outside and talk about working with adults and adults with disabilities. So the similarities are still there. We have similar diagnoses. We still have individuals that have disabilities that require a lot of care, but the age and development of them has changed. And there's several differences that come along with that. And so we're going to go into some specific ones that we feel are important to consider when you're working with those adults, and how to kind of work through those differences. You know, the science is the same, but it looks a little different when you work with adults versus working with kids. So to real quick remind everybody why it is important to expand your skill sets, to improve upon your knowledge base, to expand your repertoire. As a field, it helps, you know, with the population that we serve, and it shows our versatility and the diversity in areas that we can find our science applicable. It's also really cool because when we collaborate with other professionals who are experts in their field, really nifty things can happen. It not only benefits our clients, but it also benefits the science and the professions as well. And, you know, importantly, it's part of our ethical code. It's something that as behavior analysts, we need to actively be seeking out. You know, we have our CE requirements every 2 years for our recertification, but it's also nice to, when you go to a conference or, you know, right now doing virtual things, when you're scouring the web, you know, finding something that sounds different, that's not in your realm of expertise, it's not in your comfort zone, just to see what other people are saying and hear other people's, you know, experiences with the field and what they're finding out. That's really cool. So another area that I'm going to let Shanna go into more is the importance of expanding in regards to supervision.
Yes. So I wanted to talk a little bit about like supervision, remembering that when we are supervising, everything we say and do in front of our supervisees, and sometimes even not necessarily in front of them, you know, we are modeling how to be a BCBA for them. We are modeling how to do the work that we do. So I think it's just important that we always keep that in mind. There's in doing that, we've got to think too, is we are modeling for them. So what kind of things can we model for them? I mean, obviously, you know, the things of working with our clients, implementing programs and all that kind of stuff, but thinking too of some of the things that maybe we're not, perhaps not putting as much thought into, like
when we run into things that we're unsure of or it's outside of our expertise, what do we do? Do we shy away from those things and not let the, you know, not let the supervisee in on those things? I would say we do the opposite. I would say that's a great supervision opportunity to take those situations, bring them in on it, and show them how they're going to work through it, because it's pretty much a given they're going to experience that in their career, and they need to know how to appropriately and effectively handle those situations. Just seeing them being able, seeing us as supervisors, you know, reach out to other professionals, reach out to whether they're outside of the behavior analytic world or other BCBAs, and seeing how we can recognize our limitations, where our expertise ends and someone else's begins. So I think it's that letting our supervisees see us receiving supervision and seeing us collaborating with others is a very valuable piece of supervision. So just keeping that in mind as we're supervising, and I say this, you know, where it ties in with what we're talking about today, how many instances that I've run into this situation as I move into the adult world, working more with adults. There's just instances where it's like I had to say, man, you know, what do I do here? You know, I'm a behavior analyst. I should know this stuff. It's behavior still, but there's information and knowledge I'm missing. And so I've reached out to other BCBAs. Kelly has been one of those, and our illustrious leader, Leah, and many others. I've reached out to them. And then two, reaching out to other professionals, whether it's a speech therapist or occupational therapist. And then one thing I've really learned, probably in the adult world, working with, clients who are adults, but then also too, just outside of a center-based program, I feel like I've really had to seek out parents, caregivers, staff members, all those other people involved in the client's life that make up that team of individuals helping the client, just really gaining a lot of knowledge from them. And, even a parent's or staff member's knowledge, maybe it's just recalling, history on the client or their likes and dislikes, or just hearing, the caregiver's strengths and weaknesses. All of that has been valuable in me being able to do the work I need to help my client. And I just think it's all those things are so key in letting our supervisees see those kind of things.
And then there's other things too, in consideration of that, where it gets us out of our comfort zone. And for me, that's one of the things that I enjoy about our field is the applications are so vast and it's so broad. And there's so many cool things that we could be looking at and exploring. And it's fun to get out of that comfort zone to kind of see how other people are doing things and wonder like, oh, okay, I wonder if this would work. And you kind of get that flutter in your stomach or, your heart starts beating a little faster in anticipation of, oh, is this program going to work? I did a bunch of research and I talked with a bunch of people and we collaborated. So, it's fun to see that happen. At least for me, that's valuable. So that's one of those things, like personally, why I think it's valuable to kind of step out of your comfort zone and continue to expand your repertoire.
When you talk about getting out of your comfort zone and even kind of all the things, that financial security, all that kind of stuff, I did center-based for quite a while. Some circumstances in life resulted in me, trying to seek out a different employment opportunity. That got me into the contract world, and through doing that, the majority of the clients available were adults. So that's how I ended up here. But it definitely was getting out of my comfort zone. I'm kind of that type that I can probably make a lot of type A's cringe with some of the things I do, because it's like, oh, let's try this out. And it's great in a lot of ways because it gets me out of my comfort zone. And then I get into that realm and I'm like, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into? But again, that's where I really stumbled upon the the part, you know, like you mentioned in our ethical guidelines, where it's like seeking out supervision and collaborating with others in those areas that are unfamiliar to us. So I had to do a lot of that. And then two, you know, you kind of have that motivation of finance, you know, the financial piece. You know, it's like, I've got bills to pay, you know, I've got to do something. And so, you know, between that desire to help people and the need to pay bills and, you know, me needing, you know, in a situation where I needed to make that transition to something else, you know, all of that got me to where I am today. And I love, you know, where I am right now, but I think it does take that stepping outside of your comfort zone. And, you know, for anybody who's maybe kind of toying with that idea, you know, I think it's great opportunity to consider, you know, and as we mentioned at the beginning, you know, reach out to us, you know, if you're kind of thinking of it, but you're kind of like, how do I do this? Should I do this? You know, let's have a chat about it and possibly others who can contribute as well.
So to jump in, we're, like I said, not really to jump in. We're going to take a very short jaunt outside of the common or maybe more well-known area of working with early intervention, young kiddos, littles, nuggets, however, you know, you refer to them. And we're going to age up just a little bit and we're going to look at adults. And then we're going to age up a lot too. But even though they're older and their circumstances look different, and we'll get into those differences more, you know, specifically in a second, the science is the same. The science is applicable regardless of what the organism is. So what we're going to do with this is we're going to talk about these differences between these age groups. But I'm hoping that as we go through, you start to understand that they're not really differences, that it really is just kind of a shift in perspective. The four differences that we really categorized were the differences are in consumers, stakeholders. And when we talk about stakeholders, these are individuals in the person's, the client, the individual you're working with, their life that are invested in them and are invested in their progress. The other two categories, and these kind of will flow nicely together, are the behaviors that are commonly referred to behavior analysts for consultation. You know, and these are the behaviors for decrease, behaviors for acquisition, and then the methodologies and strategies that we use with when we're working with these individuals and their behaviors. So let's jump into, I mean, the basics of consumers. The age is the biggest difference between working with children. You're working with people who are older, and with age comes developmental changes, changes in medical and physical and biological. So there's hormone changes that happen. There's, you know, changes in metabolism, and oftentimes our individuals with disabilities struggle with communicating those kind of private and internal events. And so as the person ages, behaviors may emerge and, you know, quote unquote, come out of nowhere because of a medical issue. And so one thing that we've really noticed with working with adults is that is one of the first things that we look at when we're called in. How is the person medically? Let's do top to bottom if we haven't done it in a while. A lot of individuals with, you know, intellectual and developmental disabilities and autism that also have seizures. And so making sure that you're in contact with whoever is prescribing the medication and that everybody, again, is on the same page of why certain behaviors are being worked on, you know, what's going on in the environment, we need to find out these details. And going through the medical can be really tough. It's questions that I don't think a lot of us are explicitly trained on how to ask. And so it becomes important to communicate with other people. But it's tough because, like I said, these individuals don't typically have, or, you know, they may not have this complex verbal repertoire to say, oh, I'm engaging in headbanging today because I have a headache. You know, I, as a migraine sufferer, when I get a migraine, I have a tendency to, I'll pull on the back of my hair. I may push on pressure push on pressure points on, you know, my hands or on my face or on my ears. I, you know, if it's bad enough, I may engage in what looks like self-injury because I take the base of my palm and I hit it against my forehead. But I have a repertoire that I can say and I can use that allows people to know what's going on with me. You know, I'm doing this because I have a headache. Oh, okay. What can I do to assist you? Do you need water? So on and so forth. I can get my needs met. But a lot of our individuals lack that, or it's a limited repertoire. So they may only be able to echo what somebody says. And that's really tough because, you know, you have to be around the person for an extensive period of time to figure out what's an echo versus what's an independent response. But these are all vital and important when you're working with an adult because, in general, if something is wrong medically and we're trying to treat it behaviorally, all we're doing is putting a Band-Aid on it. And there's the potential to make things worse if we're not treating the whole package. So that's just, you know, one of the other issues that we see. And with those learning histories, there's also the potential for trauma. You know, unfortunately, we live in a day and age where, you know, children do undergo trauma and individuals with disabilities undergo abuse and neglect and exploitation. It happens. And it's something that we need to be very aware of because, like we mentioned, with medical issues, again, that is a very complex verbal repertoire to be able to talk about an event, and talk is just, you know, a step in the process. Unfortunately, a lot of people have experienced trauma, and even those people don't always have the verbal repertoire to say, this is what happened, this is the event that occurred, this was the emotion that followed, this was my reaction to it. If we're not taking consideration, the person has had a history of abuse or they experienced a certain traumatic event, that there are antecedent events out there and there are setting events that can potentially influence this person's behavior. The trauma doesn't go away. And those emotions and those feelings don't go away. Bessel van der Kolk wrote a amazing book called The Body Keeps the Score. And it is fascinating about how honestly cool our brains are at storing information and doing things and, you know, rewiring itself to assist with needs. And so for us to not consider someone's learning history and someone's potential for trauma history in our planning is really not okay and really not, you know, a good sign of our science, if you will.
So just, you know, as you're talking about trauma, just thinking of those things, because again, that was one of those things that as I started working with adults, it was kind of a new thing. And not to say that working with young children, you don't run into that, because that's totally not true, but just in my situation. And so it was one of those things where, you know, you can't just do some of those same things you had done with other individuals. You know, like I'm going to throw out a word that can probably make, you know, possibly some people cringe, but you know, there's a lack of trust on a different level when you have somebody who's gone through trauma. You know, so whether it is your rapport process, you know, and the way you intervene, there's so many other pieces that have to be taken into consideration and things added to the plan that you're doing to address that lack of trust. To address that, the way that they're dealing with it. Because, you know, like I think of people, you know, who have dealt with trauma, who are dealing with it, and they go to counseling or whatever, they may be in that for years of talking with a counselor. So then you take somebody with a disability who has limited communication abilities, and they're not able to talk about those things and share and then get techniques on how to deal with that, you know, then we as behavior analysts are either having to develop those things to help them with that, or it may be the time that we reach out to other professionals and collaborate with them at this point. But just some, you know, it's just an additional piece that we have to take into consideration when we're working with those individuals with trauma.
And I think it's good to note too, that it's not just us going in with the assertion that I am going to change this person's emotions and their feelings and things like that. No. At this point, this person's an adult. They've got that long learning history. it is going to be easier and more beneficial in the long run for everybody to teach whomever is working with them, their stakeholders, their, you know, their parents, their grandparents, family, you know, whomever is in their environment frequently and readily, to teach them to be compassionate and to teach them to take a step back, put themselves in this person's perspective and in their shoes, and try to think about how they're feeling in the situation, and the inability to communicate certain emotions and certain sensations. So yeah, there's a lot that we can unpack with trauma, and in no way, shape, or form are we the experts on this. There are wonderful experts out there. CASP Emergence, ACEs, trauma are really good resources to look into. So, you know, some of the other differences that we see with adults versus working with children are the areas that they live and learn. Because in schools, that's where you tend to see children. But once they graduate, or, you know, once we graduate, what happens? You know, for most of us, and if you're listening to this, then I'm going to, you know, hedge my bets on just about 100% of us went to university or went to a college. You know, we graduated, that's what we did. Some of us may have taken a sabbatical or two here and there, but then we had our careers. And so it's almost like, you know, for some of us, our paths were kind of laid out for us. And we had just the option of what did I want to do next? Which location would I like to be at? But if you have somebody with a disability, that's not always the go-to. A lot of times, once they graduate or once you graduate from high school, the resources drop out. The funding sources change dramatically. And the activities and the social opportunities and a lot of things that humans are naturally inclined, our primary reinforcers aren't as easily accessible as a person gets older. I've had, you know, adult clients that have told me, oh yeah, when I was a kid, my parents could call up the fire department at any time. And, you know, they would hold a little party for me and my friends, or I was able to go to this camp because, you know, I had a disability. But now that I'm older, no one wants to help me. And it's heartbreaking because I see it and they're not wrong. And especially they're not wrong because that's their experience. It's a true statement regardless, but it's really tough because those learning environments change, where they may live change. You know, if they're an adult and they're living with their parents, I mean, unfortunately, parents pass away. And a lot of times they pass away before their child, even if the person has disabilities. And so then it becomes, now where are they? You know, who's going to be the next one to assist them, that's going to provide them a home or a place to live? In Texas, we have state-supported living centers, and we have group homes, and there's foster care. But again, a lot of those have stipulations on who can be there, and it's difficult because, you know, as I mentioned with the funding sources as well for these consumers, that changes. And so, and it gets more expensive as you become an adult.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking of like the living and learning histories, this may be kind of jumping ahead to more perhaps the stakeholders part. But, you know, one thing I think of too is, you know, when you're working at a center-based, and I typically think of that as typically younger individuals that, you know, you're working with, you know, it's typically your staff, you know, that's trained in ABA, perhaps an RBT, all that kind of thing. And you're giving them a program to implement, and that is their job to do it. You know, but when you start working with adults, whether it's in their home, a foster care living situation, group home, wherever it may be, you know, you are trying to implement a plan with individuals who haven't necessarily been trained. I mean, yes, we're going to provide that training, but it's different. And that's what we're talking about today, is that difference. It's different, you know, whenever you're training those individuals and asking them to implement a plan than it is with the staff at your center, and where that's why they came into the job, is to do that work. And I mean, you could say, well, people go into a group home or a day hab to do that work. They come in to work with individuals with disability, but not necessarily to do behavior analysis, to implement behavior plans with individuals, like we think of that as behavior analyst. You know, so that's just something I think that definitely I found to be different working with adults.
Oh, I think that's perfect. And it kind of leads us into, our talk about stakeholders. And it's very different. The people that, you know, when I was working in clinics and I've worked with in-home before and training RBTs, you know, we speak the same language. You know, I can tell somebody, oh yeah, I need you to do slightly more variable schedule. You know, right now it seems like it's about every two. You need to vary your reinforcers a little bit. You know, I can give that feedback. I can use the technical jargon and they're going to understand me and they're going to go, cool. You know, and hopefully make progress from there. But if I go into, and I have done this, in my early days as a young, naive, pretentious behavior analyst, would go in and tell staff directly, this is what you're going to do, and this is reinforcement, and you're going to learn it, and you're going to love it, and you're going to live it. And they did not. There were lots of errors with that. But the big one was, I'm using a lot of jargon. And that's not the language that they speak. You know, we're behavior analysts, you know, we speak to other behavior analysts, but when we're talking to people who are not in our echo chamber, we need to take it a step down. And I'm saying this as a reminder to myself, because I do like to use my technical language at times, but I have learned that in order to be successful with the individuals, not just the individuals that I am treating or that I'm working with, but the staff members or the caregivers or the parents that I'm working with, when I'm humble and I come down off my pretentious high horse of behavior analytic language, more things happen.
Hello and great job. If you are listening for CEs, then here's the first of your two key words. The first word is flying, F-L-Y-I-N-G, like the spaceships go flying by, flying.
I think that a lot of the things we're saying of don't do this, do this, don't do that, you know, it's all like because perhaps we've made those mistakes and we're going to keep making mistakes and we're going to learn from them. So we're finding the value in our mistakes, you know, and let's try to pass it on and share. You know, I also think too, you know, I mentioned that there's the challenges and differences of trying to train staff on our behavior plans and caregivers and things like that. And, you know, let's take a group home or a day hab, for example. You know, I think that there's a huge challenge on the part of those who are for those staff, because let's take the group home specifically. They are coming in as a staff member and in employment and following the rules of their job. And so they're having to think like an employee, and they're having to get a job done. But then they also have to put this hat on to say, I'm coming into somebody's home, and when I'm at my home, this should be a place of comfort for me. It should be a place to enjoy, to relax at the end of the day, those kind of things. And so I think that staff member has challenges in thinking of, I've got to get my job done, and I've also got to remember that these are my clients' home that they're in. You know, so just really, you know, really thinking of that when we're going in and working with the staff and our clients. Just there's so many more things to take into consideration that I never would have dreamed of. And I'm going to continue to find more things that, you know, I need to take into consideration as each day goes by.
So one of the other differences that we have really seen between working with adults versus working with children is the way that behaviors are requested or the concerns that people come to us with. When I was working with children and you know, the assessments that we use typically, you know, the HELP assessment, VB map, functional living skills, the ABLEs, we have a lot of assessments. But it's cool because they all give us different information and different areas of where, you know, kids' repertoires and what they can do and what they need to improve on. And those prerequisite skills too are really important. But that's a huge difference between what we're looking at with adults versus children. So like with adults, typically we get referred for more of tolerance skills, or I get this phrase a lot, they're being sassy or they don't want to listen to me. And so there's kind of this, you know, proclivity to go in and be like, well, you know, we just need to teach tolerance and teach them how to cope with everything. But there's a lot of other behaviors that we need to look at with adults. So, you know, I will actually use a lot of times my VBMAP assessment, or I may use functional living skills, because come to find out, it's been assumed that this individual may have that skill. And in reality, they're missing some prerequisite skills. So while they're able to kind of mimic parts of it, the whole skill itself isn't there. And those prerequisite skills are necessary. You know, for example, understanding the discrimination between like a yes, no response. I work with a lot of individuals that are very good at saying yes. And when people ask them questions, that's just their go-to, yes. A lot of times because that means the conversation is going to be done sooner and I can go back to what I want to do. So this is the easiest response for me to give. And so it's kind of like saying, hey, Kelly, you know, let's talk quantum physics. Do you understand it? Yeah, sure I do. I have no idea what quantum, like I don't get quantum physics, but I just gave you a yes response. And oftentimes when working with adults, we forget to get more information and you know, we just take it at face value instead of kind of probing some more and seeing like, oh, do they actually understand the difference between these particular things that I've offered? Or do they understand the contingencies that are in place? Can they tell me what behavior they need to admit to engage in a certain consequence? And so that's just one of the areas that we kind of see with some issues is potentially missing some of these prerequisite skills. And,
you know, something that comes to my mind is, somewhere along the way working with kids, these thoughts came to my mind, but I think it was more so of when I was working with adults and I was trying to figure out what is the best way to approach certain goals or behaviors that people wanted me to with adults. And that it made me start realizing like, well, what's the appropriate end goal for this? And I think of, you know, like thinking up with children, whenever I, you know, especially as I had children and they started, you know, with each year that passed by, it was like, oh my gosh, they're sassy. They are not compliant all the time. You know, even me as a behavior analyst, I don't have the perfect children because I'm a behavior analyst. And so it started making me realize that some of this behavior we want to treat in children with autism or any other type of disability, or, you know, what have you, is, yeah, we need to work on it. Just like I want to work on that with my own children who don't have a disability. But I think we need to keep in mind, sometimes these are long-term goals. Like it's not like in 3 weeks, I need to have this, their compliance at 100%. I can't get that with my kids, you know, you know, or the sassiness is like, I need it at zero. That's not typical. That's not a normal behavior. And I think, again, it was working with, you know, I think of working with adults, I think that's helped me to realize that even more, because I think like working with adults, I start thinking of the things we're asking, whether it's a caregiver asking us as a behavior analyst, or perhaps us coming up with the idea on our own, or collectively, you know, saying like, well, we don't want this adult client to do this. And we start thinking, you know, we want them to eat healthy, let's say, but then I'm going to go get off work and eat half a bag of chips, you know, and to say like, that's not eating healthy. And so it's one of those things of just really finding that balance between, yes, we want to encourage our clients, and I'm just using one of many examples, we want them to eat healthy. And so it's that balance between trying to help them eat healthy, but being realistic about it in the sense of, why am I asking a client to do something perhaps their caregivers aren't even doing? So thinking of this with compliance is, we really need to be realistic and think kind of big picture with it, as opposed to really just trying to go with what is ideal, especially if the people around the client aren't doing that perfect ideal situation.
just to piggyback off of that, I saw this in one of the Facebook groups for BCBAs. Someone had commented about, you know, when someone talks about, especially in terms of like compliance or quote unquote appropriate behavior, the question they ask themselves is, who is this? If I change this behavior, who is it benefiting ultimately? And I had to take a step back on that because, you know, as a person, as you get older and have more experiences, you do start to, you know, you grow, hopefully, you know, let myself kind of work through that discomfort because, yeah, I would very much want to go into a situation because, well, I'm referred to make the behavior appropriate. And, you know, what's my definition of appropriate? And then it turns out that it's actually different than what the caregiver is asking. And so realizing that kind of reinforced, if you will, the who does this ultimately benefit? That's something that we really need to take in consideration, particularly with adults, because they are in a very vulnerable state. Not all of them are given a voice. They're not taught to advocate for themselves, even though they should be. Because looking at the age group that we work with, some of these individuals didn't have opportunities in school. They didn't have the resources that individuals with disabilities do now, or students with disabilities do now. And so they were kind of forgotten about. And if they do have a voice, it tends to come out in an inappropriate manner. But the thing is, it's functional. You know, if I don't like what you're saying, or I don't like how, you know, you're asking me to do all these things, no is a great response. Refusals are a huge measure of control. And looking at adults, and especially, you know, my own self, you know, moments of transparency here, I'm a very stubborn individual and I like to do things my way. And you can ask me to do something. And if I was already planning on doing it that way, but then you tell me to do it that particular way, now I'm not going to do it that way just because I'm spiteful and I want it to be my choice. Gosh darn it. And that's something that we need to take in consideration when we're working with, again, all organisms. But one of these differences of working with adults is really making sure that they have that power to say no. And we as the behavior analyst help the people that are working with them understand the function of what these behaviors are. They're doing it because this is the way that they know how. You know, no one else has taught them a different way. And so that's where we need to step up and say, okay, let's talk about this whole situation, how it got to this point. And if you want it to look different, here are the things that we're going to need to go into next.
You mentioned advocacy, like teaching them to advocate for themselves. And so that also makes me think of, I think that there's a time and place for children to learn to follow rules, and adults to follow rules. And I think that you can, again, this is something I saw and realized to a certain degree while I was working with young children, but I think it just, the importance of it grew as I started working with adults and you just saw the importance, I just noticed it more, you know, even more so as, you know, when I started working with adults of, yes, they need to be able to follow rules. There's certain times they need to do that because there's certain times I need to. I've got to show up to my job on time. I need to be respectful to my boss, all those kind of things. I mean, we all have those. And so there's a time and place for that. But I think that we can lose sight of teaching the advocacy skills to the degree that we need to. You know, like thinking of how do we teach them to learn for themselves, to make choices for themselves? Because, you know, you can get a client who's a child who receives ABA or therapy over the years. And then as an adult, they're waiting on you to give them every instruction. And it's like, well, no, it's okay. You can make whatever choice you want. And they're like, I don't know what you're doing. You're talking a foreign language to me because we've never taught them that. All we've ever taught them is to just follow our rules and be obedient or be compliant or whatever we want to call it. And so, you know, I think of that, you know, in the sense of teaching them how to make decisions, how to problem solve. You know, I was reading an article the other day about independence and interdependence. You know, and it was one of the things it was talking about is just the options available to adult clients or to adults with disabilities of, you know, what kind of living arrangements that they can have as an adult. And it really kind of comes down to What kind of skills have they gained over the years to be able to open up their options? So, you know, the less that they learn communication wise, advocacy wise, you know, kind of those things, problem solving, decision making, challenging behavior, aggressive behavior, all those types of things are going to, how well that they do with those or not so well is going to either limit or open up more options for them. Is their only option to live at home because they don't have the right skills to be in a group home? You know, can they not live on their own with someone kind of overseeing them because of the limitations that they have? Can they no longer live at home because the parents can't take care of them as they start aging because of their behavior? I mean, there's so many different things to think of. And the more that we work on these skills from early on all the way into adulthood, we are allowing that individual more options by doing so. And I say that because, you know, one thing I think that we lose sight of because we're always considering mastery, and maybe I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but, you know, like thinking of mastery is, you know, it's like, we want them to do it in a matter of weeks, you know, and I think of some of these things are long-term goals, whether long-term means a month or a year or over the years, you know, and there can be maybe benchmark goals underneath that, but you think of like when we try to change our habits, you know, there's many of them I've set out to change and I've just drifted off. And then there's some that I've stuck with. But you think of how long it took to change that. And it's so very long. And so I think we need to also keep that in mind as we're working with our clients, that sometimes these things aren't going to be, you know, quick and easy. They're going to be, you know, slow, long-term, day in and day out of practicing them. You know, like I think of, you know, whenever I need to change something, I need to practice it every day, day after day. Something that comes to my mind is, you know, something I've listened to, some talks that is based on research by Dr. Caroline Leaf about how, you know, there's probably most everybody has heard like, oh, it takes 21 days to change a habit, but she talks about three cycles of 21 days. And so the only reason I mentioned that is, you know, if you think of that is, you know, if we want to change these behaviors in clients, maybe we need more time to keep practicing the same thing as opposed to just saying, oh, they've been doing it for 2 weeks consistently, it's mastered. Whereas, is it really, you know, so just something, you know, just a number of things to consider as we're working with our client, as we're thinking of goals and trying to make sure they're appropriate goals, and also considering what do we really want to consider as true, not what we consider as true mastery, what really is true mastery.
Which is, I think, a fantastic and, here's the fun word, appropriate thought. Because, like Shanna, you mentioned, it's not about setting these goals that are unrealistic. We do need to take in consideration what the rest of the population, what the rest of the world looks like when they engage in these behaviors. You know, if they're going through a particular experience, what kind of behaviors do, you know, quote unquote, normal people do? It's not okay for us to set these really high standards. And I think a lot of us can fall into that trap, not because of our own training. You know, the criteria that we set typically isn't, you know, 100%. Usually amongst ourselves, we stick with 80 to 90%. That's the common. But when we go out and we're talking to individuals who are not familiar with our science alone, but that begs a conversation then with the people that are asking us to change someone else's behavior. Why would you like it to be this high of a mastery criteria? Oh, and going back to who does this really benefit in the long run? And I, you know, let's go ahead and dive into the differences of methodologies and strategies. Shanna started to talk about it with forced creativity. And I think that it's just such a cool concept because when you have so many variables in play, you kind of feel like a juggler, and it's not just, you know, blocks or scarves that you're juggling, but you may throw in like an egg. You may throw in like a live chicken. I don't know. And so it forces you to kind of, you know, be aware and on the alert of like, oh man, what's coming next? What else do I need to account for? And when you have that mentality, it forces you to think outside of the box. Like Shanna said, you know, going into stores when we could still do those things. Now I rely on, you know, Yelp reviews. Now I rely on Amazon reviews or, you know, consumer reviews about how things work, how it feels, textures like that, so I can send recommendations to families. It's thinking outside of our comfort zone. And, you know, I know that this works with children. You know, the science always works. Reinforcement works. You know, it's just my reinforcer may look a little bit different. The way that I deliver it may look totally different.
I'm thinking of, you know, you know, when you mention like solution, you know, I'm trying to think here. I have a couple thoughts. You know, just thinking of, you know, we really need to consider, you know, what is going to motivate the caregiver to carry on that plan that you talked about. You know, those kind of things are important to consider in our planning. You know, it makes me think of an instance you and I've talked about before, Kelly, where a behavior that almost every regard, you know, appears to be attention seeking. So let's just ignore it. That's the best thing to do is just ignore it. But sometimes that may not be the best thing, you know, through something I was listening to the other day, you know, it was a great example where we could see it as an attention seeking behavior initially, and we could ignore it, or it's an escape situation where we need to just get the person, you know, back to us so that they're not getting reinforced with that escape behavior, those kind of things. And, you know, I just think of, I think it's a time where maybe to jump in and ask a lot of questions, whether it's to that client, whether it's to the caregiver, stakeholders, something like that. You know, definitely the client, the consumer, if they're able to communicate that in any way, or maybe just through observations, you know, and a lot of asking questions of people, you know, because in this situation where I was listening the other day, it was one of those things where actually leaving that person where they were safe being left there, but just staying back and letting it happen was a way that staff member built trust with that individual. Because, you know, kind of like we've mentioned that trauma situation, you know, this was a situation with trauma where, you know, not going after them and just yanking them from their spot, let them see, you know what? I see you need to retreat for a little bit. That's what you need to regain something, you know, that's what you need to, for us to be able to build trust, for you to see. I know there's been a lot of individuals in your life, adults that you can't trust, that have proven to you that you couldn't trust those individuals, but I need to prove to you that there are adults you can trust, and I want to be one of those, you know? And so I think that this can touch on a couple of things we've talked about. Great opportunity, supervision opportunity, if you have it, to show those supervisees this piece that needs to be considered in. Also an opportunity to build that trust with the client. So not just jump into that solution automatically, but really looking into things through observation, asking a lot of questions, gaining a lot of information and insight, and then determining what is the best method.
Fantastic work. You've earned your second keyword, which is math. M-A-T-H. Algebra is a type of math.
If you are working through these differences, you know, what are the things that you need to do? And Shannon and I, it came down to two big things. Your first thing is you build rapport. You build rapport with the client. I mean, that's, I feel like, a given for a lot of us. We all get that. I remember doing early intervention and we had on our data sheet, which I thought was super cool, you know, the rapport section. So how many smiles, how many eye contacts, how many times did they initiate? And then also the moment of like, oh, I'm not reinforcing right now, when it's like how many retreats or escapes. But I enjoyed doing that because it gave me an opportunity to kind of bond with this little human. And so as I started working with adults, everybody's got a story, and somebody can tell you their story, you know, verbally, and other people tell it to you through their behavior. And building that rapport, not just with the adults that I was working with, which is incredibly valuable too, but also building rapport with the caregivers and the people that are there. I've had plenty a staff or a parent or you know, a caregiver come to me and say, you know what, today we're just going to talk. And I'm like, okay, because I think the quote is, you know, if mama's not happy, nobody's happy. So if the care, if the staff are struggling with something and they need a, and they need to have a voice and they need to be heard, man, we are prime to do that. You know, we should be listening because we're entrusting them with our programs and entrusting them with helping the individual that we've been, you know, called to serve, if you will. And so it's valuable to have that relationship. And so you just go and you listen and you don't judge and you take what they say and you acknowledge it. We don't know everybody's history. Like, I wish I could, you know, walk down the street like Sims, click on somebody and go, oh, look, this tells me their likes, their history, you know, all of these things. I get their full information. That doesn't happen. So unfortunately, you know, we actually need to talk to each other and build those things up.
You know, something else I think is really good with rapport building that I feel like we want to teach our clients perspective taking, but I really feel like we need to be practicing perspective taking too. When our parents, caregivers, stakeholders are saying stuff, when our clients are saying stuff, let's take their perspective and say, why are they saying this? Why do they want this? Why do they not want this? Or what are they going through? You know, I'm thinking through at it, you know, with my history in mind, with my life history, but what is their life history and considering it from that view. Also, there's some really good articles out there on empathy and compassion and just really talking about how, you know, there's a lot of other professions that have a lot of research articles on the importance of empathy and compassion, and even some in, you know, in our field and how, you know, it can really lead to some trust, and trust, I think, is a good key part of having some good rapport with clients and caregivers.
So yeah, I think we've touched on kind of our second point a lot, because they really do intertwine, is just the value of listening. As a reminder that when we go in, even though, you know, we are the professional and the expert, no one is an expert more than that person on themselves. And then the people that work with them. So it's important to listen, and to make sure that it's active listening. You know, like Shanna said, you're making eye contact, you're giving feedback, you're summarizing or you're paraphrasing and, you know, asking for clarification. Okay, so it sounds like during this situation, you were angry with what was happening. Oh no, I was actually really sad. It broke my heart. Oh, okay. Cause that's two different avenues that my brain can go down of how to interpret this situation.
Whether maybe you're listening to the staff and you're like, they're just sitting here complaining and tell me how nothing's going to work and how, you know, all this negativity, really? Yeah, I'm supposed to listen to this too. To me, that may say, you know what? I keep wanting to try to get this goal with this client met, when maybe if they're, I'm just going to use this, maybe there's so much negativity you're hearing from a staff member, a caregiver, whoever it may be, some stakeholder. Maybe we need to step back and say, I can keep trying to beat this intervention in, or I can step back and say, hey, I think that there is a prerequisite I need to address. And that is getting the mindset change of the stakeholder or stakeholders who have this attitude, it's not going to work, because as long as they do, it's not going to work, you know? So there's one thing of that kind of listening and saying, maybe I need to refocus my goal to a prerequisite goal.
So taking into consideration all of those variables when we're going and implementing our treatment, and we get there through, you know, what Shanna's just reiterated with building rapport actively and frequently and throughout the career of working with this client and having that active listening to go with it, because communication is a two-way street, but oftentimes we forget for that oncoming and that incoming information to hit your ear holes. So with that, this is the Atypical Behavior Analyst signing off.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.